Do you seek the freedom to pursue greater meaning and purpose in your life? Is there something that you're passionate about that you'd like to support by giving time, talent, or money? Do you seek a level of financial freedom to live an ideal life as you uniquely define it? Welcome to the Money and Meaning Show with Jeff Bernier, a show dedicated to helping you gain the confidence and freedom to lead a life of personal significance and help you get your actions and resources in alignment with what matters most.
Hello and welcome to the Money and Meaning Show. My name is Jeff Bernier. As normal, I am your host and guide today as we have our monthly conversation around money and meaning. So this show is really all about helping you create clarity and what you find valuable in your life and what brings you meaning and purpose. And to marry that with conversations around wealth management. How do we think about building the capacity? How do we build the investments and the financial resources to be able to have the ability to go live your version of a meaningful life? So that's what this is about. And we've had a good time with these shows this month. I know we only do this monthly, but we've really had some really good guests. In January, we had Tony Turner on, and we had a deep discussion around estate planning. We followed that up in February with Edward Repetto from Avantis, where we talked about using financial science to build better portfolios. In March, we had a special treat. My colleague Mona Fahmy joined us to talk about what a financial planner can do for you. We followed that up in April with a very important discussion around special needs planning with attorneys Heather Nadler and Laura Aiken-Smith. Back in May, I had a bit of a conversation with you about what I thought was timely at the time in terms of market volatility and how to keep perspective in volatile markets. And then finally, last month, we had Steve Ryder on from True North Networks. And we had a conversation around cybersecurity, which is obviously a very important topic, especially today as we are well connected. So feel free to check out those past shows if any of that sounded of interest to you. And again, thanks for being here today. You know, when I was a kid growing up, there was a TV show on that Art Linkletter hosted called Kids Say the Darndest Things. And he would interview kids, you know, children, and they, in fact, would say the darndest things. I heard a similar question recently. Someone had interviewed some kids, and it sounded kind of like that show. But a question that he may have asked these kids were, if you could have any superpower, what would you choose? And so I'd like you to think about that for a moment. Today, if you could have any superpower, what might you choose? And we'll come back to that later in today's conversation. So just ponder that for a few moments, if you would. Also, when I was growing up in my home, my mom had had a bowl, and it had a bunch of dried flower petals in it, and it had an aroma. And as you know, this is called a potpourri bowl, I think is the right pronunciation of the term. I'm remembering it because just recently I was in South Georgia visiting my father with my grandchildren, and my one-year-old got into the bowl of the potpourri. And so wasn't long before we had flower petals all over the den. So that's one definition of potpourri. I looked it up in the dictionary. There's another definition that you're probably also familiar with, and that is, according to Webster, potpourri is also a miscellaneous collection. So for instance, a medley, a potpourri of different topics. And so that's what we'll do today. I'm going to give you a potpourri, if you will, of a few articles that I've read that I think are important today, generally because of the questions we're getting from clients and other investors. And so I'm going to give you a potpourri here of a few articles and ideas that may be useful, again, driven by some of the conversations and some of the questions that some of you are asking us. But let me start with a danger. There's a danger called the curse of knowledge, and we all have this danger. You know, when we learn stuff, we like to share it. And I'm no different. I love teaching. But there's a danger here that I can get really in the weeds with some of these ideas. And so I'll try to manage that a little bit and try to pull out what I think are the most salient points. And at the end of today's conversation, I'll try to tie it up with a thought or two that may be somewhat actionable, or at least a framework. And so let me start by just talking about a belief that simple is better than complex in most things. You clearly, life is full of complexity. The work that we do in investing and financial planning and wealth management, there's a lot of complexity. But it's important that we have a framework to create some simplicity and some rules around the complexity. And that's a theme I'll come back to as you hear about some of the things I'm going to talk about in these articles. Two levels of simplicity that we bring to the table is a process, both our wealth management process, how we manage a holistic financial plan, as well as our investment process. So those are examples, I guess, of processes that can bring some simplicity to very complex topics. So again, my intent today is just to share a few ideas from some things I've read recently that I think would be helpful as you've asked some questions on these topics. Let me start by reiterating something you've heard me say many, many times, and that is, if the goal is to create real wealth over time, I believe that being a shareholder in the world's great businesses is a reasonable way to preserve purchasing power, which is what we're talking about. How do we defend against rising prices, which is obviously the topic of the day, given recent inflationary outcomes that we're experiencing. Jeremy Siegel's book, Stocks for the Long Run, that's in multiple editions. I think a new one's coming out this year. He's got data going back to the 1800s that shows real returns, that is, returns after inflation. And it shows over 10 and 20 year holding periods that being a shareholder in great businesses is actually better than being in bonds or cash. So investing in great businesses as opposed to investing money or lending money back to those businesses or lending money to the government, which are bonds, has been more profitable after the impact of inflation. So that's part of my case. However, let's say you had a $2 million portfolio. Would you be comfortable looking at your portfolio at some point in the future and your $2 million portfolio being worth $1 million, even though if I could convince you that historically it had always recovered? So that's a 50% decline, obviously. Well, this is what you have to be prepared for if you're in an all equity portfolio, if you have all your money invested in stocks, and again, in these world's great businesses. So while they are great defenders against rising prices historically, there is also, you have to a pretty strong stomach, I think you would agree. And as you move into the retirement phase of life, that can be very stressful and uncomfortable. And most people can't handle it, quite frankly. And by the way, that 50% decline assumes that you're broadly diversified in something like a total market fund or, you know, broad equities. If you just had a handful of 10 or 20 stocks, your results could be dramatically worse. And so that's what you have to face if you are all equities. And so, again, most people can't or should not expose themselves to that level of volatility. So if you've got 100% in equities, you've got to be prepared for roughly a 50% temporary decline historically. If you've got 80% in stocks or equities, you have to be prepared for roughly a 40% decline. Even if you have 60% in stocks, you've got to be prepared psychologically for a 30% decline and so forth. So the point of this is most people should have something besides stocks in their portfolios. And that brings me to my first article that I'll chat about here. And that is, what is the point of owning bonds in a rising rate environment? As I know that you have seen in your portfolios, that if you have exposure to stocks, year to date, the stocks are down somewhere between 15 and 20% roughly. Well, bonds, what we normally consider to be the defense in portfolios, are also down anywhere from 8% to 12%, depending on the types of bonds that you own. The broad aggregate bond indexes are down about 10% as I'm recording this in late July. And so the question that the article that I'm going to talk about briefly here is, what is the point of owning these bonds in a rising rate environment? Because that's what has caused some of these negative results in the, quote, safe part of our portfolio. Joe Wiggins has a website, behavioralinvestment.com. He produces some really good stuff. Joe Wiggins is an investment analyst at an investment firm in the UK, but he writes some really good stuff. So that was his article. What's the point of owning bonds? And of course, as we've seen this correction in, or bear market in stocks and this downturn in bonds, you might be asking yourself the same question. And so the negativity around bond investing today, he writes, reflects major behavioral failings we all face as investors. We greatly overweight the recent past and are overconfident in our ability to predict the future and struggle to accept the behavioral realities and the benefits of diversification. And so here are his cases for why do you still own bonds. Number one, rising yields should mean higher future returns. Studies show that the current yield in your bonds is a pretty good proxy for subsequent returns, maybe the next 5 to 10 year returns. So as interest rates have improved, that means the return on your bonds has gone up. Now you've had a temporary decline, but today, from today, your expected return in bonds has gone up. The second point that he makes in the article was that the chances of losing money in bonds has reduced somewhat because you have the interest to protect you. So even though rate rising and you might lose a little bit of principal, at the higher yields, you recover quicker. So that was point number two, why you still might own bonds in a rising rate environment. The third one is the market has all the information that you and I have. In other words, the collective wisdom of investors, they know everything that you and I know, that the Fed will probably raise interest rates. As a matter of fact, as they're meeting today, as I'm recording this, and they've projected they're going to raise them even more later this year in the first part of next year. So all that information is already in the prices of these bonds. So there's not, the only way to profit from new information is for you to know something that no one else knows. Obviously, that's very difficult to do. The next point is that there are a lot of different types of bonds, and we use different types of bonds in portfolios for different reasons. So you can't just lump all fixed income in as one generic asset class. There's all different types of bonds. For instance, treasury inflated bonds have held up much better than nominal bonds year to date, as an example. The next point is really what I just pointed out at the very start of the presentation, where I said, you couldn't be all equities if you couldn't stomach those level of downturns. And the next point that he makes is high quality bonds are great diversifiers historically. In other words, they do provide defense historically in a bad equity market. Again, maybe not as much year to date as they have in the past, but historically they have. The next point he makes is that government bonds should be rebranded. In other words, they get a really bad reputation. And as we talked about, there are a number of different types of bonds. One are loans to the federal government. And these historically have been a good diversifiers in really, really bad economic environments because there is a flight to quality. People leave risk assets and go to the perception of safety in government bonds. So they can, again, mitigate this volatility. And then finally, the future is unpredictable and we can be overconfident. So just like back in late 99 or 98, 99, we thought the internet was going to change the world. And many investors thought that, you can't go wrong owning technology companies and we extrapolate the recent past. Or even as recently as 2020 and 2021, when stay-at-home stocks did incredibly well, and we extrapolate that out, and we're in a new era, we take recent experience and we extrapolate it out. So what has just happened recently does not necessarily tell us anything useful about what's likely to happen long term. And so we just have to be very careful about what bonds are for in the portfolio. So that was paper number one that I wanted to share a few comments here. Number two is on the similar vein is from AQR. So they had a paper out, stock and bond correlations, drivers and implications. And so the major theme of this paper is that we've experienced recently over the last 10 or 20 years, a period of time of lower than historical correlations between stocks and bonds, meaning bonds and stocks were good diversifiers of each other, more in the last 10 or 20 years than has been the historical evidence going back for 100 years or so. And so their paper makes the case that these correlations are probably going up, meaning they're likely to move more together than separate. And their primary rationale for this is there's really two primary drivers of these correlations. One is economic growth, and the other one is inflation. And so if the narrative is all about growth and not about inflation, historically, these asset classes have been helpful in terms of negatively correlating. But their research suggests that when the conversation turns to inflation versus lower disinflation, then they're not as correlated. And it makes a lot of sense if you think about the drivers of equity returns, which is economic growth, which is not great for bonds, but it's not terrible. But what's really bad for bonds is inflation. And rising rates. It's also bad for stocks, but it's much worse for bonds. So they both have headwinds in an inflationary world. In a deflationary world or a low inflation world, stocks tend to do pretty well and bonds do okay. In a deflationary world, bonds do really, really well. So the point they're making is the narrative may be changing. And so the later parts of their paper and their conversations is, what do you do about it? And similar to a lot of other research recently, you might think about how you diversify the 40% that you put traditionally in fixed income. And they present a number of alternatives that have been talked about for years and years. And some of them, I think, are useful. Others are very difficult for most people to implement because they're costly and they're hard to own. One example, for instance, is private equity. You know, people talk about private equity being having low correlation to equities, to public equities. Well, they're both driven by economic growth. In other words, private businesses have the same economic drivers of return that public companies do. But the difference is they're not priced instantaneously in a free market where people are bidding the stocks up and down. So part of the reason that they're non-correlated is you just don't know what they're worth every day. So I'm not certain that that's low correlation. They both have the same economic drivers. Using long short strategies where you short parts of the market can be helpful in these kinds of environments. But again, they're very expensive to own and they're not correlated with U.S. equity. So investors oftentimes give up on them because they don't track normal markets. So there's a number of things that you might do according to our friends at AQR. The next article is very similar, but I thought it made a couple of extra points that might be worth at least chatting about. And this is from AllianceBernstein, and this is just published in early June, but it's asking the same question. You know, what happens when diversification disappears? And I think that's probably a bit of a sensational title, because if you actually read the article, you still get the benefits of diversification in traditional high-quality bonds, but similar to the AQR article, it's just not as dramatic as it was in an era where growth was the main driver. But the pointers essentially the same on the front end, and that is they're more correlated. you know, we've enjoyed a 10 or 15 year period of relatively low correlations. And so having bonds in the portfolio were great diversifiers to stocks. And while they're still likely to be good diversifiers, even according to the article, you're likely to get higher volatility. So where both articles agree is that for the same expected return, you're going to have to accept more volatility. Or for the same level of volatility, you're going to have to accept a lower return. And so the theme you're going to hear me say at the end of this talk, which is part of the big takeaway, is that I think for most investors, the behavioral aspects of managing your money will become even more important, because you may have to accept higher levels of volatility to get similar returns if, in fact, correlations are more positive. In other words, where they're not quite as negatively correlated as they once were. And of course, the people at AllianceBernstein write about a number of potential prescriptions as well that are similar in theme to the AQR research around non-traditional asset classes, factor premiums that we believe in, going long short again in factor premiums, which can be costly and hard to explain and sometimes hard to earn, to own, as I mentioned before. They talk about direct investments like real estate and timberland. I mean, there are things that are out there, but they all have issues and they all have trade-offs that you have to think about as you look at this. On a similar theme, as I was doing research and rereading some of these things I've been thinking about over the last 6 months, as the bond market has been you know, in this downward path, is an article or a research paper by Verdad Asset Management. They did some great research back during the pandemic around crisis investing and the types of asset classes that tend to do best when you're in the middle of a crisis, which is to say you're getting them at really good prices and the things that tend to do the best in recovery. And it was very useful research back during the pandemic, back in 2020, or at least the depths of the financial challenges with the pandemic, or the investment challenges with the pandemic. Well, they've got another article, more recent, that really talks about counter-cyclically investing. And they'd use a similar framework as AQR and AllianceBernstein. And they quote Ray Dalio, who is a famous investor in a hedge fund. And he said, Dalio said, investors should primarily worry about two big economic variables: the rate of economic growth and the rate of inflation. And again, this ties in very closely with the themes of the two previous articles. And what was useful, I think, from the Verdad piece is they basically broke up the economic environment into four quadrants. So you have a rising growth, falling inflation quadrant. You have a rising growth, rising inflation quadrant. You have a falling growth, falling inflation quadrant, and then you have a rising inflation, falling growth quadrant. So you basically take a 2x2 matrix of inflation and growth, and you've got these four, what they would say, secular environments. And now the challenge for investors like Verdad and Ray Dalio and you and me is, do you ever really know which one of these quadrants you're in? And Verdad uses a number of technical signals or fundamental signals, I guess, primarily around credit spreads between high yield bonds and treasury bonds and the shape of the yield curve and all these, a number of other factors. And what you come out with is certainly there are asset classes that do better in these four quadrants than others. Again, two challenges. One, how do we know which quadrant we're in until after the fact? And two, how do you implement it at low cost and with a lot of, and low transaction costs? Tax costs, because you're moving money around. But it was a really interesting article. And again, I think the themes were consistent with some of the themes from the previous two, that we just have to be aware of where we are. The next article is one you can find hundreds of versions of this article today. If you just go on the internet and Google, is the 60-40 dead? Is the 60-40 portfolio dead? You'll get tons of articles on the death or not of the traditional 60-40 portfolio, which is to say 60% stocks, 40% bonds. Many institutions have built their portfolios around this equity-tilted, balanced portfolio. A lot of research has been done about sustainable spending rates. You're probably familiar with Bill Bingham's 4% rule, which points to a 60-40 portfolio being a reasonable allocation for the retired investor that balances out these challenges around economic growth and beating inflation with reducing volatility by having 40% in bonds. And the funeral for the 60-40 portfolio has been going on for 20 years because it's been professed dead many, many times. But Ben Carlson, who writes a terrific blog post called A Wealth of Common Sense, that I take his data and share it frequently because he's really a good writer. So he wrote his version of the article, is the 60-40 dead? And again, it's easy for us to ask these questions when bonds have recently not done well. And similar to the AQR and the AllianceBernstein and the Verdad piece, you know, we've had a benign environment for interest rates. So the 60-40 portfolio has done better than you would have historically expected it over the last 20 years. So what Mr. Carlson does is he goes back and looks at a period of time where it wasn't so friendly. You know, back to 1940 through 1980, when you've had a period of time of rising interest rates. And the last part of that, you had really high inflation. Matter of fact, the 10-year period that ended 1981, I believe the 10-year inflation number was about 8%. So you had 10 years of 8% inflation over that trailing 10-year period. But over this 40-year period, 41 to 81, inflation ran 4.7%. And interest rates went from 2% all the way up to about 14%. So a really bad time for bonds. And over that period of time, the traditional 60-40 portfolio earned about 8%, which was about 3.3% higher than inflation. So certainly much less than it's earned in the last 20 years, but not terrible either. And so, again, the beauty of diversification is you don't necessarily have to know everything. You just have obviously asset classes that don't all move in the same direction at the same time that have positive expected returns. So the case that he's making is don't give up on the 60-40. Now, he's written in the past, and I'm sure he might have written it even in that article, that, you know, in the 40, you might do things somewhat differently than you did. But the point being is the bonds are there for a reason, and you might still not give up on it. So even though the death of the 60-40 has been greatly suggested by many, you might want to stick with it in theory in terms of having asset, high quality fixed income with some portion of your portfolio. JP Morgan had a piece just last week on January 20th. Meera Pandit, which is their global market strategist, wrote almost the identical article on is the 60-40 dead. Again, I just point these out because they're out there, and you can see reasons why you still want high quality fixed income as part of your portfolio. A couple of final comments on recent market activity as well. If I took you back to January 1, 2020. So we're hanging out watching New Year's football, I guess. And we're basically just looking back at the market on January 1, 2020. And we're saying, okay, how did the S&P 500 do over the trailing 10 years? And if we did the calculation, we would see that on January 1, 2020, The U.S. equity market, as represented by the S&P 500 index, compounded at about 13.5% per year. So it's a pretty darn good 10-year period. It's actually about 30% higher than the long-term historical average for the S&P 500. So if we sat there on January 1, 2020, and we reflected back on 13.5% return over the previous 10 years in U.S. equities, we probably would have felt pretty good about that. Well, if I had proposed to you that over the next 31 months, that you're not going to earn 13.5% per year, but you're going to earn the historical average, which is approximately 10% per year, over the next 31 months, most of us would have accepted that gladly. Well, that's what we just experienced. As we sit here in late July, if you look at the U.S. equity market from January 1, 2020, through the last week or so, you will have seen compounded returns of about 10%. Now, over that period of time, we've had some crazy stuff going on. We've had pandemics. We've had lockdowns. We actually had negative oil prices briefly. We have supply chain disruptions. We have 40-year high inflation. We've got geopolitical concerns with Russia and Ukraine and a lot of other stuff going on. And since January 1, 2020, we sit here today and the market has compounded about 10% annualized over those 31 months. Not really a bad outcome. I think you would probably agree. And so again, we do recency bias. We look at what's just happened over the last month or two or six, and sometimes having a longer term perspective can be helpful. Also in Mr. Carlson's blog, he quoted John Bogle recently. He said, John Bogle, who was the founder of Vanguard, who I'm sure you're all probably familiar with, he said, the stock market is a giant distraction to the business of investing, meaning you really have to have a longer term perspective on these kinds of things. So let me close with a couple of final comments and some takeaways for me, at least. The first one is, I mean, we really only have really good data going back to the early 1920s. Jeremy Siegel and others have gone back to mid-1800s with financial data. But this is still not a huge data set. I mean, it sounds like a lot of data. We take 10 years worth of returns or 3 years worth of returns, and we think that's a lot of data. And I'm telling you today that, you know, 120 years worth of data is really not a ton of data, which is to say everything that could happen has not happened, perhaps. I mean, we just have to be humble about what we can learn from the past. And the problem is, as many people build these model portfolios at Tandem Growth and other institutions, oftentimes we're using 25 and 30 year backtest. Well, I just told you in that 30-year period, we had lower correlations between stocks and bonds. We generally had a declining interest rate environment. We had low inflation. Through the last 12 years of that, we've had really accommodative fiscal and monetary policy. So, you know, it's really not enough data. So the point of that is we just have to be humble as we look at these things. And so as these solutions for what do we do about some of the challenges with fixed income, you've got to determine what is your investment philosophy and what is your worldview. And so, sure, you know, you could invest in more illiquid assets. You could invest in long short strategies that are potentially tax inefficient and expensive. There's a lot you might do, but you've got to determine where on this complexity continuum you're willing to go. And so that's what we've tried to do in our strategies is we've just determined how far we think we need to go. And I would encourage you to do the same thing. So what is your philosophy? There was a writer that went by a pen name Adam Smith, not to be confused with the 1776 Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith. This fellow's name was George Goodman. He wrote a couple books under the pen name Adam Smith. And he had a great quote about Wall Street. He said, if you don't know who you are, it's an expensive place to find out. So you've got to be clear about your philosophy, because again, you can read these articles, you can get in the weeds, and you can be convinced you've started shifting things around. And so it can be very dangerous if you don't know who you are, I guess I would say. And the market has information. Surprise and entropy and change has information. And we can use that information as we build strategies, but we've got to be clear about what are we doing as we make dramatic changes on things that could happen that we just can't know. So let me come back to kids say the darndest thing. So what was your superpower? I mean, if I ask you that question, if you could have just one superpower, what would it be? And as I was thinking about what I wanted to talk about today, in the context of my role, I might choose to be able to speak to you and maybe just shoot you with my laser eyes and immediately transform you to a rational investor, not an emotional investor. I could transfer both of us, you know, you and I, to where we're better with statistics and probability and don't get so controlled or influenced by the narrative of the day. And so what some call behavioral investment counseling, because as I mentioned, if some of these papers are right, you may have to accept higher levels of volatility for similar expected returns. And for many people, as they're funding their retirement, it's even more important. So we've covered a lot of stuff here today. I hope you found it useful and at least thought-provoking. Happy to have a conversation with you about any of it if you'd like to reach out. As I mentioned a time or two in previous podcasts, I've been working on a book for the last couple of years. I'm hoping it's out in October. It's called The Money and Meaning Journey, A Guide to Clarity, Financial Confidence, and Joy. So you'll hear more about that in the coming shows and weeks ahead. Next month, I'd encourage you to tune in again. I'll bring in another guest. Carolyn McClanahan is going to join me. She is a physician, a financial planner, and a great educator. And she's an expert on the intersection of health and personal finance. So I hope you'll check us out. If you'd like to check out other podcasts, you can see us on iTunes. You can certainly check us out at tandemgrowth.com. Feel free to email me at moneyandmeaning@tandemgrowth.com as well for any comments or thoughts or potential guest or subject matter for the show. But as always, I appreciate your attention today and hope you found this useful. Thanks and have a great day.
Thank you for listening to The Money and Meaning Show with Jeff Bernier, a show dedicated to help you gain the confidence and freedom to lead a life of personal significance and help you get your actions and resources in alignment with what matters most. We would love to hear from you. If you have any questions for Jeff or comments on the show, feel free to reach out to us at moneyandmeaning@tandemgrowth.com. Or you can find us on the web at www.tandemgrowth.com. Jeff Bernier is the President and Chief Investment Officer at Tandem Growth Financial Advisors, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. This show is a production of Tandem Growth Financial Advisors, LLC. All information discussed is general in nature, is provided for informational purposes only, and should not be construed as specific financial, legal, or tax advice. Listeners should consult an attorney or tax professional regarding their specific legal or tax situation. Listeners should not rely on the content of this podcast as the basis for any investment decisions. A professional advisor should be consulted, and/or independent due diligence should be conducted before implementing anything discussed in this show. While information presented is believed to be factual and up-to-date, Tandem Growth Financial Advisors, LLC, does not guarantee its accuracy, and it should not be regarded as a complete analysis of the subjects discussed. Tandem Growth Financial Advisors, LLC, does not make any representations or warranties as to the accuracy, timeliness, suitability, completeness, or relevance of any information prepared by any unaffiliated third party, such as guests on the podcast, and takes no responsibility for the same.